Before we get to today's episode, I just wanted to remind everybody about the upcoming Phoenix Fan Fusion Convention, formerly Phoenix Comic Con. It runs 4 days from May 23rd through May 26th, and there are tons of great guests. Just listen to some of the names. Jeff Goldblum, one of my favorite actors of all time, The Fly, Thor Ragnarok, Jurassic Park. We also have Nicolaj Coster-Waldau from Game of Thrones, Ray Park, who played Darth Maul, Amy Jo Johnson, the Pink Ranger, Robin Lord Taylor, who is the Penguin on Gotham. We have Adam Savage from Mythbusters, Paul Rubens, Mr. Pee-wee Herman himself, from the world of Star Trek, George Takei, Nichelle Nichols, Walter Koenig, and Garrett Wong. Frodo's going to be there, actor Elijah Wood, from the Harry Potter movies, Matthew Lewis, who played Neville Longbottom, Summer Glau from Firefly, and finally Billy Dee Williams, I'll mention, from Star Wars, has a big role in the upcoming Star Wars movie, Episode 9, that's out this Christmas. So again, tons of media guests available for autographs and photo opportunities, and I think it's a really great lineup they have this year. From the world of comics, they have some real legends there. Jerry Conway, Dennis Cowan, Roy Thomas, Kevin Eastman from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, super talented artist Michael Golden, Joe Staton, Neil Adams, Christopher Priest, a very prolific writer, is going to be there, Howard Chaykin, Denny O'Neill, who pretty much ran the Batman books from the late 80s all the way up through the 90s and into the 2000s, also legendary artist Kevin Nolan. There's also going to be creators like David Marquez, who most of you will remember from his work on Ultimate Spider-Man, Derek Robertson, who co-created The Boys with Garth Ennis. There's an upcoming Amazon show focused on that property. We have Greg Land, Ty Templeton, Tony Parker, Larry Stroman, along with tons of other artists and creators that are going to be there. So it's one of those shows that don't forget where their roots are from. There's tons of great comic creators, writers, and they have a great artist alley and a lot of local creators there as well. So I do recommend this show. It's one of those shows I think everybody should do. The tone and the feel of the show is unique. It's something all its own. Tons of cosplayers, a lot of Doctor Who, a lot of Star Wars. So whatever your particular fandom is, you'll probably find something of interest at Phoenix Fan Fusion. Tickets have been rolled back in terms of cost to the 2017 prices. It's only $85 for all 4 days. They raised them last year to cover a lot of the security that's in place. And I think all that's still going to be in place, but they listened to the fans and they heard that, yeah, the prices were a little bit too high. So they're certainly competitive when you compare them to the 4-day cost of a lot of other shows, or the per day cost, I should say. And there's tons of events, tons of stuff going on. They close the streets next to the convention center. There's food trucks out there, lots of covered seating where you can sit in the misters and eat some good food and just hang out and have a really great time. It's going to be fun. As I said, I do recommend everybody getting out to Phoenix Fan Fusion. I'll be there covering it for the Comic Source and LRM Online, and I hope to see you there. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 704 of the Comic Source podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Spotlight Friday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about a couple of recent DC books, Justice League number 16 and Freedom Fighters number 2. All right, on to the books I'm going to talk about today. First one up is Justice League number 16. It's from the creative team of writer Scott Snyder and James Tynan. Tynan handles the script. Jim Chung and Steven Segovia are on pencils. Chung, Mark Morales, and Segovia handle the inks. Tameyu Morey and Will Quintana are on colors, with Tom Napolitano on letters. So if you've been following along with our Justice League spotlights, you'll know that the recent story has been the Hawkworld story with Jon Stewart, Martian Manhunter, and Hawkgirl having gone to Thanagar to try to meet with the Martian Keep, who is supposedly the last surviving Martian other than John Jones. And she is sort of the keeper of the history of not only Mars, but a lot of secrets of the universe, actually. So this issue opens up, and the Martian Keep is actually narrating, and she's talking about something that happened way back in ancient history of the universe. She says, they gathered the evidence on Maltus with dawning horror. They had found it carved on tablets on primitive worlds. They found it painted in caves. They found it echoed and distorted over 1,000 worlds in 1,000 languages with 1,000 faces. And we see some of these tablets that they found, and it shows a female figure holding what looks to be a planet above her head. And the Martian Keep goes on to say, the myth spoke of a universe before our own, a universe shaped into a predatory state by an all-powerful cosmic mother wielding the seven energies of creation. It was the story of a perpetual universe, dark and dangerous, designed to never die. It was the story of its creator and how she fell. Then we're in Sector 2814, where we know Maltus existed, and we get a flashback to Krona, who was the Malthusian who looked at the beginning of time in his hubris and created the multiverse by looking at the Big Bang, basically. And it goes back to that scientific theory of you fundamentally change something if you observe it. So Krona was responsible for the multiverse. You know, we learned about him in the pages of Green Lantern many, many, many years ago. He played, we learned more about how his viewing of the creation of the universe, the Big Bang, created the multiverse and Crisis on Infinite Earth with that story. So Krona has been a big figure in terms of the history of the multiverse, and here we're learning more. So it goes back to what we've talked about several times on the podcast in terms of the scope of this Justice League story that Scott Snyder is telling. It is a huge story. It has epic consequences for the entire DC universe, and not just the current DC universe, but he's really inserting things into the past of the DC universe, unlocking more mysteries. So this is what I like. You know, I don't particularly care for retcons as much as any comic fan does, but when you're additive, when you're not taking things away, when you're not saying, okay, that story you read back then, that's not really how it happened and it doesn't matter, it doesn't count, or it's a lie. They're not doing that. Snyder and Tynan, what they're doing is they're adding on to what's already there. They're building up more story, more nuance, more detail, and more complexity. That's fair to say. Not everybody goes in for the continuity and the complexity, and I get that. But I don't know that you need to have a complete understanding of the DC universe in order to appreciate the story that's happening here, because it stands on its own as well. Anyway, the Malthusian scientist Krona ordered all the evidence gathered, and they were going to hide it. Any evidence of this universe that existed before, and this all-powerful mother creator who obviously is Perpetua, all evidence of her is to be hidden. So they can study it themselves, but not allow anyone else to have any knowledge of it. And hopefully they can understand it and prepare if she ever returns. So they scoured the galaxy. They were able to hide her mark, the signature of her power. And the story of Perpetua, the knowledge of it, is really the most dangerous secret in creation. And should it ever come to light, it may cause problems. So the meaning behind her symbol is hidden away as well, because she would rise again if anyone were to find that symbol, anyone were to unlock that power. And the symbol that we see on the page is the symbol that we've seen throughout this story, the symbol that's on the doorknob that Luther has. And clearly he now has knowledge of Perpetua. We know that she was hidden away inside the totality, somewhat like an egg. And we know that Luther, in a previous issue of Justice League, was able to steal that totality. And we know that he is trying to bring her back, I think, without a clear understanding of what it is she actually is. You know, Luther, and if he's anything, he is arrogant. You know, he exhibits a lot of hubris and believes that he knows the answers to things. And he come to find out, he's bitten off more than he can chew. We've seen that story many, many times. So I'm sure that Luther, despite his intelligence, is not learning from his past, and he's going to wake up Perpetua, and it is not going to go well for most of the multiverse, as well as he himself. I don't think he realizes what he's getting into. So back in this issue, we're back in the vault on Thanagar Prime, and John Jones is telling the Martian Keep, you're telling me that they've kept the secret all this time, ever since the universe has existed? And she says, yes, there's power in a secret, John. Cronut understood that, and he knew how dangerous that symbol could be. And now we're seeing that symbol story come to life because Perpetua is nearly formed. She's nearly returned. And John says, well, I don't understand. I thought that the symbol originated on Mars. The top aspect of it, we used it on Mars. It stood for justice. And this is very important. The Martian Keep explains the symbolism, what each of the lines on that symbol mean. She says the line across the center represents the source wall. And the seven lines beneath it represent the dark energies of creation that were sealed away. So it's what was on the other side of the source wall. So that's why we've never seen these energies, these seven dark energies before in our multiverse. They were sealed away behind the source wall. So we hadn't seen the ultraviolet lantern force. We hadn't seen the strength force or the sage force. It was all hidden away. We just had the seven lines above the line that represented the source wall, which were things like the speed force and willpower and such that we knew about, because again, the rest were hidden away beneath. They were below. They were the dark part of creation, and they were sealed away behind the source wall. So the Martian Keep goes on to say, the seven lines above it represent the more positive aspects of unbound and vibrant in the universe we know. For all of our history, the balance has remained positive, justice, as you say, and the old energies that were meant to be locked away for an eternity, they've reawakened. And now they're giving terrible power where there was none before. And so even as Shiara has been able to do with the Absorbicon I now wear, she's been able to rewrite reality itself and create this illusion of Thanagar and bring that illusion to life, make it reality so that she could have a world for her people after Despero attacked. This is all powered by my mind. And it would be impossible if those energies hadn't been freed. But I'm dying. I can't maintain this illusion. And John, there's so much more you need to know. So you need to listen closely while I pass, or when I pass, rather, because the illusion of Thanagar Prime is going to fall away to nothing when I'm gone. And chaos is going to unleash itself across the universe. I'm no longer going to be able to hold these secrets. So basically, this issue is the Martian Keep exposing these secrets, telling John the things that he needs to know, or the things that she has time to tell him before she passes that he thinks to know. It's probably not everything he needs to know in the long run. I'm sure he'll discover things down the line that he wishes the Martian Keep had told him, but that's, you know, really just a plot device in the way. But the reason I mention it and about the structure of the story with the Martian Keep revealing these secrets, I mention it because it makes for a very wordy issue, as you know, can tell so far. I mean, we're only a couple pages in, and I've already been rambling on for a long time. So you have to bear with me if it seems really dense. I get that. But as the story keeps unfolding, and we get to the Justice League annual with them trying to seal the walls, it starts to fall into place and make even more sense. And you really have to admire the ambition and the complexity and the skill with which Tynan and Scott Snyder are telling the story. So back in the main kind of center of the vault, sort of away from the hallway where John and the Martian Keep are communing, we have the battle. The rest of the Justice League is there, along with the Green Lantern Corps, who showed up, and then Shiara showed up with Katar Hall and a lot of her Thanagarian guards to try to prevent them from discovering the truth about the Martian Keep and the truth about Thanagar, how Thanagar Prime, how it all is just an illusion right now. So as we turn the page, we see Kendra fighting Katar Hall, and she's trying to reach him, saying there's got to be something of you in that sad husk. You got to fight back. You are a hero both on Thanagar and Earth. You can't be willing to go along with Shiara's madness. And we get this quick look at Katar's eyes, and there seems to be life there, but there's no response. He does not seem to be himself. And so Shiara responds, saying, he can't hear you, Kendra. He's just an echo of the man he was. But as our power grows, as it has been growing the past few months, I'm going to be able to restore him entirely. And Kendra says, you know, you sound insane. Meanwhile, the Green Lantern Corps, they're not sure which side to be on. They're not completely understanding what's going on. So Kilowog tells John Stewart, you need to stand down. You're crossing into outright insubordination, and that's always been Hal Jordan's territory, not yours. And John's trying to reach him, saying, listen to me. The last two green Martians in the universe are in the vault right there, and one of them's bound against their will. And Kilowog's not having it. He's like, then you should have come to us. You should have come to New Oa and reported it, and we could have done something about it. And we could have brought a whole contingent of Lanterns over here to get to the bottom of it. This isn't your jurisdiction. Thanagar Prime is under the jurisdiction of the Green Lantern Corps, not Earth superhero teams. So Kilowog goes on to say, I don't get it, John. I really don't. I thought you were done with all this Earth nonsense. You were going all in on the Corps. What happened? And John says, you know, I was running from myself, Kilowog. I was running from my past, running from the real danger growing on Earth, and I can't do that anymore. And this is a reference to the events of Cosmic Odyssey, which John was involved in, and we know they were unable to prevent the destruction of the planet Zanshi. And John Jones had helped John Stewart come to terms with that. He realizes that part of why he was running away from Earth when this threat was growing is because he didn't want another Zanshi. He didn't want another time where he was involved in something and wasn't able to prevent the destruction of a world. And it's even more poignant and important to him and impactful to him because it's Earth. It's his home world. So we know he was running away from that. And again, when John Jones recruited him for the Justice League, that was something that John Stewart had to face. And he tells Kilowog, don't you see what's happening? The whole multiverse is dying. I'm done standing on the sidelines. Meanwhile, back in the chamber, Martian Manhunter is telling the Martian Keep, I don't understand. You say you're dying, and yet you're talking about the machinations of beings that were at the beginning of time. How is anything that happened way back then relevant now? And the Martian Keep says, I'm talking to you of ancient beings because I'm talking about you. So listen while I educate you and explain. Time passed and the Malthusians evolved into the Guardians of the Universe. So we know that. That's sort of common knowledge for most of the superheroes in the DC universe. And she says that these Guardians kept all of the knowledge of Perpetua hidden here on Thanagar Prime in the vaults, you know, the most secure place in the universe, supposedly. But they always feared that she would rise again. And there was another aspect of the myth, and it was the story of her army. Her army was a dangerous predatory race, and it dominated her dark universe. And the Guardians feared that army might rise again. And in time, the Guardians noticed a scar that you could trace backward and forward in time that pointed to the world where she would rebuild her army once again. And we saw that. We saw the evidence of that scar being played out in the first issue of Justice League, when we saw the totality streak across the sky, and not only was it streaking across the sky in terms of space, but also through time. We saw that multiple people from multiple time periods saw that totality tear across the sky in different time periods and eventually land on Earth, right? So we know that's why Earth, for whatever reason, is at the center of this story. So the Martian Keep goes on to tell John, this race of warriors, her army, it was built from the DNA of humankind and Martiankind blended together. And when the universe was corrected, when it was put right and Perpetua was locked away, the species were split apart, Martians and humans. And the humans carried the fire, the passion of Perpetua, the desire, if you will. And that was the aspect of Perpetua and the aspect of this army of hers that humans carried. But because they got the fire, the passion, the desire, it left them weak in body and mind. But the Martians carried the power of the mind and the body, but they had no passion. They had no fire. In fact, they feared fire. Fire was their weakness. So they were somewhat less emotional, because they feared fire and the fire of passion itself in all its forms. So despite the Guardians' best effort to keep all this a secret, eventually there was a band of Earthmen, of scientists, that learned the truth. And even though they unraveled the truth, they didn't necessarily understand the danger. What they did know, or what they did believe through kind of the arrogance of man, of humanity, is that they were somehow less than they were meant to be. Like, look, way back in the past, we had Martian DNA and human DNA together. We're descended from these beings that had great power. And so they looked for a way to return to that, to return to the power, so they could find a way to become what they once were. So in order to do that, they needed Martian DNA to re-engineer the race that they used to be. And so the Martian Keep says, John, this is your part of the story, and it's what I've wanted so desperately to hide from you. The abominations that the human scientists created, they never would have been possible without source DNA of a Martian. It never would have been possible had they not abducted you. And John says, wait, what are you saying? And she says, you've seen the glimpses of yourself as a boy in a cage, John. You know I'm telling the truth. Didn't you wonder why you, in all of our planets, you were the only one who was saved by Aerodil's experiment? It's because you were marked, John. You were marked by the story of Perpetua and the part you would have to play in it. And John rejects that, screaming out, no! So meanwhile, back in the main chamber, Shira is attacking Kendra, saying, I've had enough. I've done what I've had to do to save my people. Thanagar lost its homeworld. We lost our wealth. We lost our loved ones. But we still had power. And if we were willing to use it, we could rebuild our civilization. And it could be built on a secret. And Kendra, I promised that we would build again. And in the meantime, I cannot let our weakness be revealed. By using the Absorbiscon and the Martian Keep, I've been able to change reality itself and shape reality to match what the universe thinks that we are. And I still have that power. And I'll seal off this vault with you and everybody else inside of it to forever to keep my people safe. And Kendra says, how could you do this? This is not right. And Shara responds, stop pretending you'd do any different if it wasn't Earth. Drop the high and mighty act. I know you. And Kendra says, right. And I know you well enough too to hear the fear in your voice and know what you're really afraid of losing again. And it's Katar Hall, right? It's the love of her life. That's what Shara really fears. And she says, all right, enough. And then the Green Lantern Corps surround Shara, and Kilowog says, enough. If you've done half of what they're saying, we're going to have to put you under arrest. You need to stand down while we investigate this matter, because you're going to have the entire Green Lantern Corps descending on this planet in a matter of minutes. And Shara's not about to give up. She says, you know what? Your rings can only do so much. The Absorbiscon can help me reshape this world, and in my world, you're outnumbered. And so as a bunch of her Hawk guards attack, Kilowog says, John, I'm going to kick your ass when this is all done. You know that, right? And John says, yeah, fair. Right? I've got you into this mess. So back in the chamber, the Martian Keep is telling John, she's apologizing, actually. She's saying, my sin is the same as Shiara's. I've kept secrets. And I thought that it was the right thing to do to protect the last of our kind, because I worried if you understood your role in the greater tapestry, it would have frightened you into inaction when the people of Earth needed you most. It would have driven you inward. And we can't have that. We need you on the front lines to fight this battle. And so this lie served its purpose and it's run its course. And now that the secrets are uncovered and have been laid bare, you're ready to face the truth. Thanagar is going to have to be ready too, because I can't hold on any longer. Shara has been pushing the power of the Absorbiscon to its limits, and all that I know is going to pass on to you when I die. And I don't have all the answers, but I hope with what I'm passing on to you and what I've been able to tell you, that you'll be able to find the answers you need to save the multiverse. And John screams out, no, you can't die. As the Martian Keep says, you know what? I survived the death of Mars. I've survived tens of millennia thinking my species was lost, only to find you eventually. And I'm glad to have met you and to have known you. And remember that the symbol, has two meanings, justice and doom. And it's going to be up to you, John, to tell the multiverse what shape to take. And she passes away. And at that moment, Shara enters the chamber, saying, no, I won't allow this. And she takes the Ozorbiscon off of the Martian keep after trying to revive her, saying, please, my lady, remove these outside threats. I know you can do it. And when she realizes that the Martian keep has passed, when literally the walls of the Thanagarian vault start shaking, she takes the Ozorbiscon onto herself, and she's going to try to use her power and whatever power is in the Ozorbiscon and maybe remnants of what the Martian keep left in it to bring the Martian keep back and to make her young so that she can make this permanent. Meanwhile, John is screaming in pain as all the knowledge from the Martian keep is being passed on to him. The Green Lantern Corps enters the vault chamber as well, saying, what the hell's going on here? And how are we going to stop all these hot guards as they are attacking? Like, I thought we had defeated the guards that were in here. You know, how many can she possibly have? How many can she make? We're going to be overrun. So John says the world's destabilizing because basically Shara doesn't have the power. That Martian keep does, the mental power. And so he puts his hands on Shara's head, saying, Shara, you've got to let this go. It's going to kill you. And he sees what's in Shara's mind. He feels her pain and the loss as so many of her people died in the attack by Despero. There's only tens of thousands left of the billions that were here before, the billions of Thanagarians before Despero's attack. And the fact that she found this key, this Ozorbiscon, the fact that she thought she could use that to bring Thanagar Prime to life and make the planet whole is foolhardy, right? That's not the way to rebuild. What Shara needs to do, what the Thanagarians need to do, is embrace the truth and rebuild open and honestly with help from others in the universe. And if not, he's going to doom her people. Or she, rather, is going to doom her people. So Shara comes to her senses, and she removes the Ozorbiscon from her head, saying, I'm sorry. Sorry for my hubris. Sorry for all of this. I've got to let the universe see how weak Thanagar truly is now. And as she takes off the Ozorbiscon, we see all these hot guards disintegrating. And she tells them, no, they're not disintegrating. They were never here to begin with. And she turns to Katar and says, I wish this were really you. I wish I could kiss you. I don't want to say goodbye again, as he fades out of existence. And she crumples to her knees, saying, I thought I was trying to do what was right, but I know it was selfish too, but I was just trying to help my people. And John Stewart says, yeah, we get that, but you're still under arrest. Kilowog's like, no, that's my line, dude. You're still suspended. And Kendra steps in and says, no, this isn't right. The universe is terrified and has every right to be. Locking her up solves nothing. We know there's a horror to come, and the hardship that we face, we need to face it together. But Shara says, this is where the greatest secrets of the universe were kept, and we're not going to do anything. None of us are going to do anything together, because now that this has happened, the locks are going to be triggered and we're going to be sealed in here forever. There is no escape. And John Stewart says, we have 5 lantern rings right here. I'm sure we could blast our way out. And Kendra says, no, we know the vault's stronger than willpower. It's hopeless. And then a voice off panel says, no, it isn't. And we see the symbol appear in the air, but it's just the 7 lines above the source wall. It's just the positive aspect of the power. And through this portal that's opened, we see the Trinity, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, as well as Starman. And Kilowog tries to read the power levels coming off of Starman, and his ring says they're incalculable. And he's like, oh, hell. Meanwhile, John Jones says, Starman, I see you woke up. How did you know to come here? And Wonder Woman tells him, he could hear you, John, all the way across the universe. He literally has the power of the totality burning inside of him, burning bright as a star. And Batman adds, hence the name. So Starman says, Kendra, it's strange to see you and Shara like this. And Shara says, what do you mean? I've never met you before. And he says, yeah, but I know you, and I can see what's happened. When the totality broke the chain of resurrection, it split you, right? It split your two lives simultaneously because Perpetua didn't want you whole, which is an interesting concept. You don't usually think of Hawk Girl or Hawk Woman as this really important character in the DC universe, but apparently she is. Apparently Perpetua sees her as a threat, so she obviously must know something or have some abilities beyond what she's aware of or what we're aware of. And we've seen hints and clues of that in the story that Snyder and Tynan have been telling so far. So Starman says, yes, she was afraid of what might happen if you were there to face her at the end. And he reaches into Shi'ar and she's like, wait, what are you doing? He says, I was doing what I was sent here to do. I'm making things right. And he takes whatever he pulled out of Shi'ar and he gives it to Kendra. And she says, whoa, what are you doing? What? Whoa. It's like a piece that's been missing in me since I died as Shi'ar Hall is back inside of me. How's this possible? How can you know how to do that? And Starman says, well, there's many broken things in the universe and it's time we started fixing them. And Shi'ar says, well, does that leave me with something less? Did you just rip my soul out and give it to her? And he says, no, of course not. Your soul's your own and your story's your own. And I've given that back to you. So it's like Shi'ar Hall is not... She had something inside her that I don't think she was necessarily aware of. And maybe it's that link that she sort of subconsciously felt with Kendra that she acknowledged when they first met at the beginning of the story arc. It's that part that's been removed. So she hasn't lost any of who she is as a person, but Kendra is now more than she was. So Starman tells them all that Thanagar Prime has an important role to play in what's to come. There are still thousands of Thanagarians on this world. They're going to need a leader, and they've got to rebuild without the Absorbiscan. And others will come to Thanagar's aid, and he can see that it's happening already. So he tells Shi'ar, you know, you have a second chance to fight for your people, and you've got to do it the right way like you always know you should have. And Shi'ar thanks him, and Kendra goes to her and starts to say something, Shi'ar interrupts and says, no, listen, you're right. Before I could read the map in your wings. It's charting the way to a higher plane of existence, this very high-like, godlike dimension. So be careful. Don't follow it lightly. And meanwhile, Kilowog's telling Jon Stewart that he understands he's on a journey and he doesn't really understand everything that's going on in this big, crazy cosmic crap. But he's not going to take Jon in. But if something goes wrong next time, call for backup. So it seems like Stewart's sort of on the side of Angels again in terms of how the Green Lantern Corps sees him. So Starman opens the portal back up and says, it's time we got back to Earth. He says, I haven't eaten anything since 1988, and this kind of power takes a lot out of you. So as they head toward the portal, Batman turns to Martian Manhunter saying, did you find what you needed to? And John is thinking about the picture in his mind that he was given to him of himself as a small child, was given to him by the Martian Keep. And he says, yes, I suppose I did, but there's someone I need to find, someone who might be the key to tipping things back to justice, back to the right side of that line, the lines that are above the line that represents the source wall. So as Kendra heads to the portal, she sees Starman looking at her strangely and says, you keep looking at me. What's wrong? And he says, nothing. It's the opposite, really. I can see how things are starting to line up perfectly finally. And you're finally ready to fulfill your destiny. It's time to fix the source wall. And the story will be continued in Justice League Annual 1 as the Justice League attempts to repair the source wall. So interesting turn of events here. I certainly didn't expect Shi'ar to go free, if you will. If anything, you could say she wasn't really a villain, not really the villain of this particular part of the story, but more misguided. You know, that line where she tells Kendra, you know, don't be so high and mighty. If it were Earth, you would be doing the same thing. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, there's a difference between rebuilding and creating an illusion. You almost look at what Shi'ar did as comparable to what Hal Jordan did after Mongol destroyed Coast City, you know, that famous Emerald Twilight storyline by Ron Mars, where Hal used the power of his ring to recreate Coast City, and then, you know, didn't have enough power because of the 24-hour limitation, and you know, went crazy, and then it got retconned later that it was partly due to parallax and all that. But again, it's him doing bringing back the citizens of Coast City, but not in the right way. It doesn't honor their memory because it's not really them. It's an illusion. It's not real. And just like Hal Jordan wanted to get more power from the central battery of Oa to make that illusion permanent, that's kind of what Shiara was doing here. She wanted the Martian keep to have more power and to use the Absorbiscon to make the illusion reality, right? So the love of her life, Katar Hall, could be restored fully, and Thanagar Prime could be restored fully. It's not the right way to do it. There's enough, you know, unlike Coast City, there are survivors here, tens of thousands of survivors of Thanagarians, and so they can rebuild, and the universe will reach out to help them. And as Starman said, he could see it happening already now that people are becoming aware of the destruction that still exists on Thanagar. And in a way, it's in the interest of a lot of these other races of the universe to help, because the vault is still there. And so Thanagar Prime does need to be rebuilt. Its defenses need to be up to speed so that no one can break into the vault and steal their own secrets. So again, interesting that how it all turned out. Shiara kind of, I won't say she got a free pass, and we may see her pay later after the more pressing matters are resolved. But for now, she's still in charge of Thanagar Prime, and she's going to be helping her people rebuild. Also, the things that were added on to the beginning of the multiverse, like I was saying before, about Tynan and Snyder building on, adding more nuance, more complexity, more details to the story, and us learning about Perpetua's army having been humans and Martians fused together. So, you know, going way back, and I'm not exactly sure how this works in terms of talking about evolution and things like that, but it's a comic book, so, you know, we're not going to nitpick too much. But it's an interesting concept, right? The fact that this army of Perpetua's was a human-Martian hybrid and the forebears of both the races once their DNA was split. And finding out about John Jones as a young Martian child being somehow captured and held on Earth and being the one that was sampled, whose DNA, the Martian whose DNA was sampled in order to try to recreate that race. It's fascinating. I mean, that's something that we've never heard before about John Jones and his history. And I wonder how it fits in with the Martian Manhunter story that Steve Orlando's telling over in the Martian Manhunter miniseries, and if these two will contradict each other at all, or if it all can fit together in the same sort of continuity. Because I've wondered with how important Martian Manhunter is in the story that Snyder and Tynan are telling. I mean, he's the leader of the League, and I do feel like, especially considering how long he's been around, he's not that well known of a character in terms of, you know, like you're talking Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, even lesser characters like, you know, Mr. Miracle, Booster Gold, Blue Beetle. There's not as many people that know Martian Manhunter, that know John Jones. Even like Hawkman, Aquaman, Flash, Green Lantern, they're all known, I think, to the general public more than Martian Manhunter, but Martian Manhunter has been there since the beginning as well, so I'm just not sure why he never caught on. But Snyder and Tynan are making him, obviously, a key figure here in this epic story that they're telling, and so it's not surprising, and in fact is kind of gratifying in a way, to see Snyder and Tynan sort of give John Jones his due and have him be such a central figure in the story, have him tie in, you know, even his younger self, kind of create an explanation for why he was the one Martian to survive the destruction the destruction of his race. I was going to say the destruction of Mars, but the planet still exists, but his race is no more. So really, really interesting how much story revolves around John Jones. And I imagine we're going to learn more because, again, now that he has these memories from the Martian Keep of the fact that this happened to him when he was a child, he can't deny it. You know, as much as he wants to,
this did happen, and you can only imagine that he's going to want to sort of research it and find out more about what happened, and can he somehow use that knowledge to help repair the source wall or to help fight the army of Perpetua. The fact that his DNA was used, if Perpetua does recreate her army in some way, if Luther helps her with that, can John Jones' DNA be used to find some kind of weakness with the army, is what I'm speculating. So I guess we'll see. As far as the art goes, I'm not a huge fan of the fact that it was Segovia and Chung together. But again, it's the fact that this is on a biweekly schedule that makes it tough for any one artist to handle all the art duties. I remember being pretty excited when we heard at the beginning, the announcement of the Justice League title from Snyder, that Chung was going to be the artist, but he's done so, I don't want to say so little of it, but he's done less than I expected, right? Jorge Jimenez came on as well, and we thought it was going to be Chung and Jimenez who were handling it, but I think Chung just isn't as fast as Jorge Jimenez, so Jorge has done the lion's share of the work, and we've seen Chung do some issues here or there, but I wonder if Jim didn't realize just how much work was involved, because this is a team book, and it makes it that much harder when you have to illustrate multiple characters. So the majority of this book, the beginning of this issue, is Segovia, and the art is done pretty well. It's not the best Segovia art I've seen, and I don't know if that's due to him feeling rushed or if he's just working with inkers that he hasn't worked with before. The lines seem a little bit more heavy than they normally are. And again, the inkers are Chung, Mark Morales, and Segovia, and I think Chung and Mark Morales work together a lot, so it may be that Morales just inked the Chung stuff and Segovia inked himself, and maybe that's the difference in the Segovia art. I'm used to seeing his art inked by somebody else. But again, I think the lines are just a little bit heavy, and so it's not as, it doesn't feel as dynamic as it would otherwise. I still love the layouts. I still think the art is great. The storytelling that both these guys exhibit is absolutely spectacular. It just goes to show how talented artists are now. I remember when I was a kid having to go back much more often to the previous panel and try to understand the transition. It happens so rarely now, it's not even worth mentioning when it does, almost. But when we get over to the Chung art for the last few pages here, again, I'm reminded how much I like Jim Chung's art, how detailed he is. I love how much detail he puts into the backgrounds. I love the emotion and the angles he chooses a lot of times for his panels. So I'm a little disappointed that we haven't gotten more Jim Chung art in this Justice League run. Almost like, can we just put him on a whole arc where he can do the entire thing? Like maybe have him start two arcs ahead of time, you know what I mean? And let him work on something that's not going to come out for, you know, 2 months or 3 months, just to give him a chance to really put his stamp on it. Because again, I'm a big fan, but we haven't gotten enough of his art, I feel like. So, but the biggest thing, as I was saying, having both of them on this issue is just that their art styles aren't very cohesive. And so you get that jump from one page to the other where the art style really changes kind of right at the end, which is just a little bit strange. So all in all, it's strong art from both of these creators. Their strengths are just a little bit different. And so, again, it makes it feel not quite as cohesive as it normally would. But the color work from Tameyu More and Will Quintana is excellent as well, which we've come to expect on the Justice League titles. It's very much traditional superhero, diving deep into the history of DC. It's not necessarily for the easiest, I was going to say for new readers, but I think new readers can get the hang of it, but you have to be willing to put in some work. I think it's much more suited for longtime DC fans, and I think Scott Snyder has even said that before, how this is really a love letter for longtime DC fans, because they are reaching back through the history of DC and pulling in so many amazing stories and characters and little tidbits here and there. So it's almost like, okay, if you really want to read Justice League and get everything out of it, where do you start? Like, I think you have to go all the way back to like Crisis on Infinite Earth and read that to, yeah, I mean, it's crazy to think you need to go back and read that much DC history, but honestly, I think you can pick up and enjoy the book on its own without having a huge knowledge of the DC universe. And the internet is a thing now. You're able to Google and learn all kinds of things if you have questions. It's all there on DC Wikia or various other websites. There's a lot of resources out there. You know, Manny, he hasn't been reading comics that long, and he's pretty well versed in the DC universe himself, certainly in the more recent history. But when he wanted to dive in, that's where I started him with Crisis on Infinite Earths, telling him, I know it's going to be kind of crazy and I'm throwing you in the deep end of the pool, but you just kind of have to just put your nose to the grindstone and get through it. Just keep reading, even if there's things you don't understand, and eventually things start to make sense after a while. So I know it's one of the complaints about comics these days. There's so much continuity and it's hard to understand and get caught up on things. But again, if you want to, the resources are out there. It's available. If you want to read it just for the pure enjoyment of the story, that's a possibility too. And if you don't want to read it because you think there's too high of a barrier to entry, that's okay too, because there's plenty of other great comics out there, a lot of independent stuff and what have you, that you don't need a lot of history of the DC universe to pick up, or the history of the Marvel universe or whatever. In fact, the next title I'm going to talk about here, Freedom Fighters, you can pick up the first issue of that and dive right in without needing to know anything, because Robert Venditti, the writer, gives you everything you need to know. So let's go ahead and dive into issue 2 of this 12-issue maxi series. As I mentioned, the writer is Robert Venditti. We have pencils by Eddie Barrows, inks are by Iber Ferreira, colors by Adriana Lucas, letters by Darren Bennett. So in the first issue, we saw how the Freedom Fighters of Earth-X were finally defeated. In this version of Earth-X, the Nazis were successful. They did basically take over the world in World War II, and their metahuman war machine basically conquered the planet. One of the last things they did in the 60s, kind of the final nail in the coffin for Earth-X, was them finally defeating the Freedom Fighters and Uncle Sam. So it's been a long time since America has believed in any heroes, because they're not around anymore. And that's how this issue starts off, where, you know, we did see at the end of last issue, some new Freedom Fighters show up in Dallas, Texas, and sort of stand up to the Nazis, which was the first time that it happened in a long time. So this issue starts off with some narration saying it has been a long time since America's believed in heroes. Some people are too young to have ever seen one. So there's older folks in the crowd that are so old they'd almost forgotten. And others have spent their lives with their heads down because it's safer that way. But no matter what the story is, none of these people watching this battle think about life, liberty, or the pursuit of happiness anymore. They don't have American dreams. America doesn't really exist anymore. And that's how the Nazi conquerors want it to be. Well, to hell with that, say these freedom fighters. So as they're fighting this giant iron policeman, we get some little blurbs here that tell us who they are. We are introduced to Doll Woman, a tiny package with a giant attitude, Black Condor, who carries the weight of the world on his wings. And again, these are new, updated reincarnations of previous Freedom Fighters, of DC characters from the past. So this doll, it used to be Doll Man, now this is Doll Woman. This Black Condor is African American. We're also introduced to Phantom Lady, From the Darkness Comes Light, and then a new human bomb, the Man with the TNT Touch. And they're living the American nightmare, because again, the American dream doesn't exist. So they're fighting this giant, 50-foot tall iron police robot of the Nazi regime. And as Black Condor draws his fire, the policeman fires at him and hits the museum behind him instead. And a Doll Woman screams out, "The people!" And a Black Condor requests that Phantom Lady teleport the rubble. So she creates these little discs of these little teleportation discs, I guess you'd call them, and actually has the rubble reappear above this Iron Policeman, where the stuff falls out of the sky and lands on him instead. So he says, the Iron Police says, assessing new terrorist threat, you know, obviously these superpowers are something he hasn't encountered before, and he goes to stomp on the Phantom Lady, with the human bomb showing up saying, clear out, I'm about to make a mess. And he fires up at the Iron Policeman as it brings his foot down on top of where Phantom Lady was standing. And this has the effect of knocking the Iron Policeman back onto the ground and into the building that the museum was housed in. The museum, which was basically dedicated to showcasing the evidence of the eradication, the final battle, the execution of the previous freedom fighters many, many years ago. So as the building explodes and this Iron Policeman is laying there, Human Bomb says, sorry I broke your war museum, but I hope everybody saw that. Because in this world, in this Nazi America, there are cameras everywhere. You know, Big Brother literally is always watching. And sure enough, at the Dallas Metro Police headquarters, they're watching through that camera. And one of the officers is saying, the Iron Policeman is down, you know, the Iron Policeman. And these policemen who are monitoring this, these cameras say, the Fuhrer said the freedom fighters were captured and killed years ago. Where are these people coming from? And then the commander, wondering how to respond, then receives a call. It's from the Fuhrer himself. And he says, of course, right away. And he says, dispatch the transport, schnell, which means now. And we see in the Fuhrer's office, it's actually Adolf Hitler II now, Adolf Hitler's son who's in charge. And the crowd is back at the scene of the battle. The crowd is looking on and kind of murmuring to themselves, like, man, 50 years, I've never seen an Iron Police on its back. Like, how is this possible? Who are these people? And Human Bomb is telling the robot to get up and fight like a man. Meanwhile, Black Condor dismatches the doll woman, saying, you're up. She says, going down, and she cuts a little hole in the hide of the robot and climbs inside. Well, as Phantom Lady says, didn't know if you could actually do it, Bomb. And, a little bit of character here, a little bit of characterization, understanding. And it seems that Human Bomb has some self-confidence or some self-image issues, because his response to that is, everyone's good for something, even me. So meanwhile, Black Condor calls out to Phantom Lady and Human Bomb, saying, the bozo's awake, he's getting up. So we see the robot begin to climb to its feet, saying, re-engage terrorist. And Black Condor wants to know what the status of Doll Woman's mission inside the robot is. And she says, don't wait for me. So Phantom Lady starts teleporting all the people out of there to get them to safety, because the Iron Police robot is launching all these little mines with no regard to any bystanders or human casualties. His mission is to destroy these terrorists, and, you know, he doesn't really care about collateral damage. So Black Condor picks up Human Bomb and literally drops him on top of the robot. And in this incredible double-edged splash, where again I have to call out the work of Adriana Lucas, as this robot explodes with a giant doom. It's pretty fantastic. The line work is there, but it's sort of secondary to what we see in the explosion of color. So the robot falls over with a high hit, and Black Condor's worried about Doll Woman, saying, you still with us? And she says, yeah, I rung my bell, but I'm good. And I never thought I'd say this, but thank God for German engineering. And she plugs into the computers of the robot, because apparently the part of the mission was to retrieve some sort of data from this robot. So meanwhile, the bystanders who've been teleported to a safe distance are wondering who are these people? They said they were freedom fighters, but where did they come from? And we see that ground troops of Nazis have now arrived, and they start rounding up all the bystanders, saying, "We need to round them up for re-education and bring me the terrorists." So obviously they don't want these people who've witnessed one of these giant iron police robots being destroyed. They don't want them spreading that. They don't want Americans to have hope that they can become what they once were. And so Black Condor attacks while Doll Woman tells them that the download is complete. Meanwhile, Human Bomb is talking to a small kid saying, "You feel that weird sensation growing in your chest? That's hope. Seeing is believing." And the Nazis, they like want to keep a tight lid on hope. And today, us freedom fighters, we blew the lid off. So tell your friends. Then we see some sort of ship or transport show up. Apparently, it's called the Blue Tracer. And as I said, it's a blue ship, but it's covered with red and white stripes on the bottom and some stars. So clearly, some imagery there of what America used to be. So we see the pilot saying, "We've intercepted Nazi comms. There are more jackboots coming. It's time to bug out." So as the freedom fighters prepare to evacuate, Black Condor is saying, "Today was a message to the occupiers. This fight is only the beginning, but we can't do it alone." And Phantom Lady adds, "Yes, America can be what it was meant to be, but we need you to make it happen. Tell your friends." And as they escape up into the ship, the Blue Tracer, they pamper the crowd below with leaflets with a picture of Uncle Sam holding the flag saying, "Tell your friends, even better, tell your enemies. Freedom is on the way." And the flyers themselves say, "Bring him back and believe," because it's been hinted at all along that in order for Uncle Sam to come back, he needs Americans to believe in him. And meanwhile, on the next page, we get a scene of someplace called the Heartland, where we see a tombstone with an eagle on top of it spreading its wings. We see a tree in the background. I'm going to assume it's the Tree of Liberty. And the Heartland apparently is this extra-dimensional realm of ideas. And the dialogue boxes over this page say, "Heroes exist. They inspire the good." As we see the bystanders that saw this iron police robot destroyed are cheering and holding the banners, the flyers above their head. So heroes exist. They inspire the good to see a ray of hope. And we see light begin to shine down on this tree, which again, I'm assuming is the Tree of Liberty. And the evil feels the flood of fear. And as we see that, or as we read that dialogue, we see the boy that Human Bomb was talking to carry the flyer into an alley. And as he passes somebody else standing in the alley, this man says, "Hey, kid, join the party. The heroes are back." But this boy is not what he seems. And when the good hope and the evil fear, sleeping giants awake, and at the bottom of the page, we see what looks to be Uncle Sam open his eyes. Where exactly he is he fully restored? We don't yet know. And on the final page, we see that the boy himself is something more than he appears, as he starts to turn gray and transform. And he says, "I have a field report. I must see the Fuhrer at once." And we see he's actually one of these plastic men. And he's wrapped up that man who told him to join the party in his arms. And he appears to have broken his neck. And we get the title page and the credits. Chapter 2, The Sleeping Giant. The Sleeping Giant being hope in America has been awakened. And next issue, Deep Sixth. So this, again, as I talked about when we covered the first issue, is an incredibly nuanced and interesting story, a modernized take on the Freedom Fighters and Earth X. You know, it's a concept from the Golden Age publisher of quality comics. You know, Phantom Lady, Black Condor, Uncle Sam, these are all characters that existed in that in that universe, the Quality Comics universe, which DC eventually bought. And so, you know, I know in the 80s, we had the All-Star Squadron written by Roy Thomas, where a lot of these Golden Age characters were sort of retconned into the DC universe. And we saw Uncle Sam and Black Condor and all these guys show up there and recruit members of the All-Star Squadron to go and fight the Nazis on Earth-X. But this is this is not that story. This is a different story. This is a story of a multiverse where Earth X, the Nazis, were able to conquer the world through using their own superhuman program. Obviously, these plastic men have roots with Plastic Man, who's another quality character. Eel O'Brien apparently was somehow, his powers have been passed on to all these secret police, this SS. So there's a ton of great characters in quality comics. We've seen a few of them here: Black Condor, Doll Woman, Human Bomb, Phantom Lady, but there's so many more that could show up. The Blackhawks, Firebrand, Kid Eternity, Manhunter, Midnight, Miss America could show up. That's one that would definitely suit this story. The Ray, the Red Bee, the Red Torpedo. Again, so many other quality comics characters. So it would be great. I hope we do get to see more of these characters. They weren't all members of the Freedom Fighters, but they were part of the quality comics family, and it would be cool to see them show up. But beyond that, I just love that this is a modern take on a story that has roots in World War II. The term "the greatest generation," the nickname "the greatest generation," has been given to a lot of those heroes that fought in World War II, and we sort of romanticize it. And I don't really get on board with that kind of thing, because a lot of people did die on both sides, and obviously that's not a good thing. We grieve for those, but I love that the story has its roots there, because it's been so long now, over 50 years, over 60 years since World War II ended. And it's important that we don't forget that the sacrifices that were made. And I think that telling a story like this, that's modern and with incredible art and incredible color work and really interesting, helps to remind us of that without glorifying what actually happened, right? And the other thing is, it's always so strange when you talk about comics taking real world events like a world war. Like if Superman wanted, he really could have, he's so powerful, couldn't he have ended the war? So it doesn't really make sense, you know what I mean? Like if you say that superheroes fought in World War II, then it really should have been over a lot sooner than it was. So, that's sort of glossed over, which is also why Earth-X sort of existed in the first place. Because you want to tell these stories with these interesting characters, but you want to tell them in the context of when they're created, but you can't have history play out the same way, because again, if all these heroes go and fight on the side of the Allies, then the war ends quickly, or it should. Or what you do is you do what DC sort of did in All-Star Squadron, which is then you give the Nazi superhumans as well, so it kind of balances out. But again, I love the fact that this is a more modern telling of the story. Venditti starts out with the idea that the Nazis won World War II. And this is an Earth-X that doesn't have any resemblance in reality to what actually happened in our real world history, obviously. But again, it has its roots in those stories and those heroes and the sacrifices that so many made in World War II. So love the context, love the story, love the idea of it celebrating patriotism and trying to reawaken the American dream, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I'm looking forward to seeing Uncle Sam return, and I'm looking forward to hoping that I see other quality comics characters show up as well. I mentioned the artwork, how incredible it is. Eddie Barrows is a really, really incredible artist. I don't know, other than this Freedom Fighters series, I don't know that I've seen Iber Ferreira ink him before. It gives his art a little bit more of a sketchy style. It's not quite as clean as I'm used to seeing it, but it does kind of suit the story that's being told, because it gives it a little bit more of a dour look in a way, sort of a realistic look. And the colors by Adriana Lucas, as I've said before, are absolutely incredible. The work he does on these explosions, because really this issue is one big fight, and so you get a lot of explosions, and they're sufficiently bright, but yet it still fits in with the theme of the issue, because overall the colors tend to be a little bit drab, which you would expect when you're telling the story of a country and a world and a planet that's been taken over by these fascists, right? It's not bright, happy days with blue skies and rainbows. It's fascist. It's, you know, the people are being downtrodden. They're dour, they're morose. And so you kind of need the color palette to reflect that. And it does completely. It's a great job by Lucas. But you run the risk there of when you do have these giant explosions and you use bright colors of it looking incongruent, right? It doesn't fit together. And he does a masterful job of making it fit. And again, the splash pages by Barrows, along with the colors by Lucas and the inks by Ebar Ferreira, really, it's super impactful. Like when you see that full page splash of the Iron Politzit exploding, it blows you away. Like you turn the page and you're just like, wow, that looks amazing. So my hat's off to the entire creative team. Freedom Fighters is an incredible series that really, really you all need to be reading. So hope you all enjoyed this Spotlight Friday. Be sure you follow up this episode 704 by listening to episode 714, which has our Justice League Annual number one Spotlight, which continues the story of the totality and the entire epic Justice League story that Scott Snyder and James Tynan are telling. So
you can find the Comic Source podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.